This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Earthwise, Environment and Peace with Justice interviews on Plains FM 96.9.
Welcome to Earthwise. I'm Martin Griffiths. For today's program, Lois and I are delighted to be talking with the distinguished scholar, Dr. Binoy Campmark, born in India, a Commonwealth scholar at Selwyn College, Cambridge, and now a senior lecturer at RMIT in Melbourne.
Well, Martin, and I've been following a case of Julian Assange. It's a story that has us very disturbed, and it's not being covered in New Zealand mainstream media. So welcome to Earthwise, Dr. Binoy Campmark.
It's a pleasure being with you.
Well, Binoy, Julian Assange is an Australian citizen born in Queensland in 1971, and he founded WikiLeaks in 2006. What exactly is WikiLeaks and what is its purpose?
Well, the purpose of WikiLeaks fundamentally is to provide a very different, rather more radical approach to the way citizens, and this is general citizenry, access information. So Assange has called it scientific or forensic journalism. It's the idea that classified information sources, material like that, be it they, for example, government material sources and corporate sources, be made available for public consumption, quite literally at the pressing of a button, so through the website called WikiLeaks. So that's one aspect of it. The material is usually classified, and it's obtained either through hacking or it's obtained through people who have disclosed material in a secure server through WikiLeaks. So the purpose of it essentially is to be a kind of a central clearinghouse for whistleblowers the world over in terms of exposing government secrets, materials, and so forth. And that's a primary thing, a primary purpose of WikiLeaks and Assange's mission, I suppose you'd want to say.
So in other words, it's a way for a would-be whistleblower to protect themselves if they're afraid of losing their job, say.
Yes, so very much so. Also, from the perspective of supplying a different tool of readjusting power, if you like, and accountability. So the idea and the premise behind WikiLeaks is to keep the powerful transparent, as it were, but to hold, to also keep privacy of citizens. So there's a flip side to that. The issue is to respect the importance and autonomy of citizens, but also to ensure that the powerful in society are kept under watch and guard, as it were.
And when did he become sort of well-known as a household name almost?
Well, he actually first made it to the, started making waves, as it were, with the organization's release of certain material connected with, be it atrocities that had taken place in certain theatres of war. He was certainly already, and he became quite a big name, for example, with the disclosure of the collateral murder video, which is, of course, the infamous video of an Apache helicopter gunning down individuals in Baghdad. And in surrounding environs. And one of the most striking things about that, of course, was the language used by the pilots, which is very graphic. And essentially, what, of course, did feature were attacks on journalists as well. So rather grim footage that did actually propel him to some fame. But, of course, he essentially became a household name with the, as it was called, not perhaps very gracefully termed, but the cable dump, it's called Cablegate, in 2010, when something like 250,000 State Department, this is US State Department cables, were released en masse on the WikiLeaks website. So that guaranteed his name as a notorious figure and also has guaranteed, I have no doubt, a good deal of time to worry about the efforts being made by US authorities to nab him, as it were, which is, of course, one of the things we'll be talking about.
And in fact, he's become a figure of hate among the mainstream media and among the government authorities, hasn't he?
Yes. Oh, he has. I think one of the things about Assange is how deeply misunderstood he is as a kind of figure. He's not a Well, he's not a lovely, cuddly creature by any stretch of the imagination. He's quite prickly. He's very much a person very absorbed, as it were, in his mission. And he has, of course, been criticized as being vain, as being narcissistic, and so on. But this is all very easy and tends to ignore the fundamental mission and the role of WikiLeaks, which, you know, is, of course, terrifying governments and officials, because it's, you know, there is a sense that individuals operating within government circles, should they wish to reveal material, and I think this is very relevant to what's happening in the context, certainly in 2016, with the disclosure of the Democratic National Committee emails. There's the official version of that is that Assange received material from a Russian agent, which is something that they're trying to sort of pin on him. But the other version of it, which I actually think has just as much, if not more so, plausibility, is material that was given by a disgruntled Democratic Party member working within the organization and the committee. This is one of the things that's very fundamental to realize. The point is that he receives information that is under lock and key. It is released to the public, and then, of course, people discuss it. But very often, individuals who might have liked him initially, or even had sympathy, came to dislike him because of the consequences of disclosed information. You know, it's like water. It goes where it wants to when it's released. People make their own interpretations and draw their own conclusions. And he's fairly open to all sorts of routes that this interpretation takes place, which makes him a troublesome figure for those who want heroes and those who want figures like that.
Just go back a bit, just a brief minute, for the convention, the collateral damage. This was the Chelsea Manning video, wasn't it?
Yes. It's very important to note that, very importantly, then, Chelsea Manning was then known as Bradley Manning, was a private who actually did have access to digital troves of information during his time in the army, and this led to quite a trove of material being passed on to WikiLeaks, including the Iraq and Afghan war logs, and amongst them, of course, discussion of military deployments and also, importantly, the tactics being used, and some of them not, of course, particularly pretty. And in addition to that, actually, the link also with the State Department cables. So Manning is an instrumental figure in this whole chapter as well. You know, Manning, in a sense, made Assange as well, so they're very much linked and bound by that.
She came to New Zealand recently.
Yes, and Australia, of course, did not allow Manning to come.
Right.
To
yeah, I did. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yes, this is one of the curious, this is one of the outrageous things. There was, initially, Chelsea Manning was given the impression that she'd be allowed to come to Australia, but then, as I think New Zealanders and your listeners might be familiar with, there's a certain charming Home Affairs Minister in Australia by the name of Peter Dutton. Peter Dutton had decided that Chelsea Manning did not pass the character test that is in the Migration Act. So by virtue of that character test and also the issue of being convicted for a felony for crime, and so having deemed Chelsea Manning to be she was convicted actually for a series of offences, initially up to 35 years for a period of time, which was then subsequently commuted under the Obama administration. But because that record is still on her paper, as it were, has blotted her book, Dutton saw that as a good excuse not to let her in. So Australia did not receive her. But yes, I'm very aware she did go to New Zealand.
Of course, Julian Assange is, not exactly under arrest, or is he?
Yes, he's in a very interesting state, as it were, of something of a kind of a legal purgatory. He has been in these conditions for 6 years, in a state of what has been called unlawful arbitrary detention. It's been deemed that by the international tribunal that does of the UN that does investigate these things, the working tribunal that investigates instances of such detention. Black letter lawyers, those beady-eyed wonders, tend to sort of see Assange as not being in detention in an unlawful sense, he is there by his own will, and he can walk out anytime he wants. But you see, this is where it gets a bit complicated. It's a rather naive and silly reading of it, because the moment he leaves the premises in the Ecuadorian embassy in Knightsbridge in London, he will, of course, be nabbed by the local constabulary. And given the recent confirming, and so many of us were already aware that this was happening, but the confirmation that he is being sought under indictment in the United States, this would simply lead to a U.S. effort to seek extradition from him from the U.K. to the United States. And I see no doubt of that happening should he walk out the embassy. So the result, therefore, means that he is essentially in a state of detention. It's not the sort of detention that we regard as conventional, but you could certainly regard it as that.
I mean, the story is that he was accused of some sex offences in Sweden, and he allowed
the Swedish prosecutor to go
to England to interrogate him. Isn't that right? And they refused
Yes, how it worked, it's quite elaborate and multi-layered, this story, but it features, the suggestions, and he was never formally charged about this, but there were suggestions and there were accusations that were made that he had allegedly committed sexual offences, but he was never charged about this. It's very important to note that. He was, first of all, the Swedish prosecution team initially filed or sought to question him. They then dropped the case because the ladies in question did not insist necessarily pursuing this, but then reinstigated it as sort of in a timely way, and then insisted on him having to go to Sweden physically to be questioned. It's a rather odd thing, because these questioning matters can be conducted on phone, they can be conducted via video link, and so forth. Then finally, just last year, the Swedish prosecutor did actually make a visit to the embassy in London. Over the matter of time, the particular charges have expired. So the main thing now that he faces is nothing in terms of the sexual accusations which have passed this course of time, even if the Swedish authorities wanted to charge him. The issue rather now is the issue of course, avoiding the bail, as it were, skipping bail and actually going into the Ecuadorian embassy 6 years ago. And so for doing that and for not actually acceding to the wishes of the UK authorities to be extradited to Sweden, he faces, initially would face a misdemeanor, but of course the problem here is that what additional proceedings would follow in that light.
You're listening to Earthwise, broadcasting in Christchurch on Plains FM 96.9, in Hamilton on Free FM, and Waikanae on Coast Access FM. Today's guest is Melbourne lecturer Dr. Binoy Campmark, and we're discussing Julian Assange.
Julian Assange requested asylum at the Ecuador embassy, and it was granted by the previous president, Rafael Correa. Ecuador has a new president, doesn't it?
Yes. So the previous president, Rafael Correa, was rather sympathetic. Let's not get too cozy about it, but he did see Assange as a very useful thorn in the side of the United States. So for the period of time, he was a fated tenant, as it were, a fated guest of the Ecuadorian embassy in London. A whole slew of noted celebrities and activists, of course, visited Assange during this period. He had essentially unlimited access to materials he could distribute and engage in, and his publishing activities were generally, and for the most part, left unmolested. But then, towards the latter part of Correa's time, but then also with the new president, who actually has a name, Lenin Moreno, he has made it very clear that he would like to resolve the Assange issue. And that resolution, of course, and there's no two ways about it, will involve him having to leave the embassy somehow. The big question is how that's going to take place. So a few suggestions have been made. One of them is the suggestion that Assange be essentially deputized as part of the Ecuadorian diplomatic mission and be sent to Moscow. So one of those connections with Russia might be utilized. But the British authorities have made it very clear that this is not going to provide him immunity, and there is a special convention in Britain that unless you are accepted as a member of the diplomatic crew to the court of, you know, St. James, if you're not actually accepted in that context, then you are not given immunity and diplomatic protections that come with that. So the upshot of that is that he doesn't really have much in terms of options in that front, and so negotiations between the British Foreign Office and between and with Ecuadorian officials still continues, and we're not entirely sure at what point, you know, the U.S. authorities are playing in this, but I have no doubt that if they're not at least cursorily involved, they have some sort of engagement with this too.
If Australia wished to help Julian Assange, could they sort of give him asylum, or he's still subject to this?
Yes. No. And this is the thing. You see, technically, being himself already an asylee, I mean, he has already been granted that status under Ecuadorian protection. So that even that protection doesn't seem to extend to being acknowledged by the UK authorities. So even if Australia was to provide some form of arrangement, that would not necessarily protect Assange either. But suffice to say that the Australian role in this has not been very glorious at all. And if anything, Australia has shown a lamentable record towards protecting its citizens in difficult situations. Of course, it's Australia's rather infamous for essentially abandoning one of its citizens, David Hicks, to the legal machine. The extra-legal machinery of the military tribunal system in Guantanamo Bay.
That's right.
And I think it's very important to note that it's been, you know, successive governments have been astonishingly reticent, and when they have said anything about Assange, they've been judgmental, and already, even though Assange has never broken any Australian rule and law, I might add, but previous prime ministers, for example, Julia Gillard, you know, amongst others, have said that essentially Assange has broken the law and should be treated accordingly as a fugitive and a criminal. So with that sort of attitude, it's little wonder that the consular help and offices being provided by the Australian side of it is minimal.
But there are fears that he could even end up in Guantanamo, aren't there?
Well, there are fears he might end up in certain facilities. Guantanamo is not the only one, but it's certainly a probability that he would end up in instances where, yes, individuals who are kept, who are classed as terrorists or information or threats and so forth, you know, and that's something that's, of course, extremely worrying for a man in his condition. It would also be very worrying for his health because, you know, he has an assortment of health issues that would play into this too. I want to add that it may well be, and this is, of course, much crystal ball gazing, and I don't want to do too much of that, but there is precedent to suggest that individuals in his position, and I'm thinking of the cyber hacker Laurie Love, who managed to resist successfully deportation and extradition to the United States for alleged hacking offenses against the US, a British citizen. He managed to, and actually, interestingly enough, Theresa May did say that it would be inappropriate for Laurie Love to be extradited because it would result in certain mental ruin and possible suicide on the part of Mr. Love. So there may well be instances of an out, but I think it's a bit dangerous to experiment with those hypotheticals in Assange's case, given the sheer high profile he has and given the fact that US politicians have more or less openly advocated for his assassination.
It's what strikes me is the contrast between the attacks on Assange, even by, say, corporate media, and the people who are alarmed by the way he's treated and think it's a threat to all of journalism, the people I respect so much, like John Pilger and Chris Hedges and Jonathan Cook. They see an attack on journalism, the attack on Assange. Do you think that's
yes, yeah, exactly. I think it's a very important point, and I think it's a point that's not made enough of. And you alluded to this earlier on with the general silence in mainstream media, say in New Zealand, but not just in New Zealand, in many countries where, you know, he's not seen as a neat fit, you know, in the Fourth Estate. He's not seen as one of the a media member like us, because he does deal in certain methods that are deemed unconventional. But if you were to be very formal about the application about what he does, he is a classic journalist as well. He deals in material that is obtained in circumstances that might be deemed illegal. He obtains material from individuals who have obtained classified documents in circumstances that will be deemed illegal.
Is there an attempt?
But that's just the lifeblood. But that's the lifeblood of journalism. It's the lifeblood of the Fourth Estate's role in scrutinizing the powerful and members of office.
Yes, it could be a warning to all journalists, couldn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Is there an attempt to accuse him of say, being a spy or a traitor? He can't be a traitor of America, can he? Because he's not an American.
Yes, that's right. As much as they would like to, and I think certain American officials do, are of the view that inside the breast of all of us beats an American waiting to get out. But in a general sense here, he cannot technically be considered a spy. So what he would do, or, you know, considered a treasonous and so on towards U.S. interests. So what they would try to do, and there are a range of possible offenses under the Computer Espionage Acts and so forth. It's dealing in traffic materials, you know, that's what they call it. So this is an offense that's often used or used to target individuals who obtain material off servers, for example.
The time is almost up. I just want to mention the plea on his behalf made by his mother. It's quite moving. He's being treated terribly, isn't he? As if he were... I mean, he's being treated.
No, he is. The reality is that people in rather powerful positions are out to get him. And he is in a situation now where he's caught between, landlords that have lost interest and actually are getting rather irritated with him, and the prospect of being thrown to the hounds in terms of extradition proceedings in a country, in the United Kingdom, which has, of course, a very close security relationship with the United States. And in the meantime, access to him, of course, has been restricted. Let's not forget that one of the issues here, one of the tactics adopted by the Moreno government has been to essentially degrade his patience and his strength, mental strength, by restricting access altogether. Contacts were restored recently, and there have been visits from certain journalists to see how he's keeping, but he is under warning.
And his health is fading, isn't it?
So it's very restricted at the moment as to what he can do, what he's permitted to do in terms of how he uses communications. It's also worth noting that the Moreno government is very keen to establish better relations with Washington. So that's another aspect that also complicates his fate, because Moreno has made it clear that he would like a better security relationship with Washington, and he's also made it clear that he would like concessions from the U.S., so, for example, debt relief. Yeah. And so forth. And that actually has played out. It's come to light recently that this may well have been on the conversation between Moreno and the now convicted Paul Manafort, of course, Trump's campaign manager for time, when they were having discussions in 2017. And Manafort and Moreno supposedly had a conversation, or a couple of conversations, which did feature about advice on how best to deal with Assange, and so on.
So I'm afraid we're going to have to say goodbye. I mean, this story should affect anybody who believes that the public have a right to know what the powerful don't want the public to know.
Yes, I think it's a very salient instruction to us about what happens when conventional forms of power and those who wield it get agitated and get upset and get concerned that they might be put under the spotlight. You know, it's the way that's been done. It's also the fundamental issue about letting the public see the materials in all their form and letting the public see what secret diplomatic transactions take place between powers and so on. This is the sort of thing that totally disturbs the official narrative of history. And that's something that is to be celebrated, but is something that evidently those in power would like to see punished. And so that's the battle we see as best reflected in Assange's fate.
So thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much, Benoit.
It's a pleasure anytime. It's very good to hear from you again.
Thank you so much.